Thanks, Dave and Ben. A great song, and what an intro to Zacchaeus there that I'm intrigued by. That's wonderful. Long weekend. Hope everybody's doing well. Got the nice weather now, but this Sunday is our final week in a little mini-series here on power and abuse within churches, and I feel like over these 3 weeks, I've like just scratched the surface on the topic, but there are other places we must go before the end of the year, so it's time to move on. But how do you wrap this up? Well, ultimately, I would love to be able to answer a big, massive, important question. And the question is this: how do we prevent abuse of power from happening within the church, the big church, within this church, and within our lives and relationships? That's the question I was hoping to find a specific answer to when I began studying, reading about power. This was the question I was dying to wrestle through and go, okay, if we can find an answer to this, churches would remain healthy, we can do this. And in the first week of our series, you know, we talked about the tempting neon lights of power, the temptation to exercise power over others. And then the second week, we talked about humility as an antidote, at least one step in the right direction against the problem of exercising abuse of power over others. But ultimately, at the end of the day, staring at this big, massive, important question, how do we prevent the abuse of power from happening within the church, within this church, within our lives and relationships, I'm left with an uncomfortable answer. I don't know. And I want to dive into why I don't know in a second, but at the same time, I want to push us towards something I believe Scripture points us to, a vision of an alternative form of power that exists and is unleashed when we are among and with one another. And yet, when it comes to the preventing of abuse of power, I honestly don't know. And that's because I think there are two subtle temptations when it comes to living into a posture of power over others. There's two temptations about power that I think are irresistible for us humans. And the first one is this: we're tempted to believe we should use power over others for good. We can use power over others for the work of God's goodness and justice in the world. And the temptation here, I think, is that while many of us know about the unique corrupting abilities of power, we still believe that holding power and exercising power over others is truly the only way things get done in the world. It's the only way the world actually changes. It's the only way things get done. And power might be corrosive, but it also works. And if we're interested in changing the world, then power is needed, and it must be used, no matter how dangerous it is. Andy Crouch has written a book, All Things Considered, decent book. But his attempt to reconcile the potential abuse of power and harm and marrying it with power as a necessary tool resulted in him writing a book called Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. And in it, he argues what I've mentioned, what our task is, the important thing is to get the right people into positions of power. And what we need, according to Crouch, is Christians of character who are in right relationship with God, in the right positions so that they can exercise power for God's justice in the world. We need more Christians to bring about the kind of change God wants to see in the world. And the idea is power gets things done, so let's get the right people into positions of power. And I was thinking about this, and I regret to inform you this morning that I am going to be applying for another job, because there's only 32 of these jobs in the world, and one just opened up this week. The Maple Leafs general manager. And it's available, and I feel that if you got the right person, me, into power, then maybe we could bring a Stanley Cup home. Yeah, right. But that's the idea here, and I think if you look across the spectrum, the last five, 10 years at churches that have broken, fallen apart, fallen leaders. The important thing that we can't ignore is that many of those churches and those leaders knew how to get results. They knew how to get things done. And if the desire in the church is, well, we need to grow, we need to make sure that people come to faith, then the way to do that is to exercise power, because power gets results, and nobody wants to argue with results. When people's lives are being changed, marriages healed, people coming to faith, who can argue with that? And what subtly creeps in is that I think in the church, in the Christian world, we still believe that power is actually the axis the world spins on. So what we need are the right people in positions of power. And if we think this temptation is only for the religious, well, I think we realize that essentially every time we partake in democracy, we're voting for the same sort of thing. A secular version of this as well. What we need is to get the most righteous people, the most progressive people, or the people who think most like me, we need them into power so they can exercise it for the change that we believe we need to see in the world. Get the right people some power. And no matter how you crouch it or how you sort of, what language you put around it, this is where the ultimate temptation around power, I think, is revealed. The temptation is that we believe we know best how to wield power in the world. And it doesn't matter if it's in our relationships, at home, with friends, with coworkers, maybe it's that organization we volunteer for, in the church, in politics, local or national, we equate being right, just, and worthy as a license to exert power over others. But no matter how right or just or worthy our cause, I think it's worth asking ourselves, are we sure we know how to hold and manage power over others? Brian Kloss, this quote of his makes me uncomfortable, but it's a good one. In his book, Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, he says, too much attention is paid to the notion that power corrupts. Not enough attention is paid to why corruptible people seek power. I don't know if any of you watched The Lord of the Rings over the course of this series. I didn't. I was planning on it, but it's not right. It's got to be in the winter or fall for me that I... But this is the message of The Lord of the Rings. Because time and time, character thinks, if I held the ring of power, I could do good with it. If I held that power, I'm a person of enough character and integrity, I could do well with it. And time again, we see, you've fallen for the temptation. Are we sure we know how to hold and manage power over others? And this leads to a second temptation, the temptation to believe that we can protect the exercise of power over others from abuse. The temptation is to think that the way we protect churches and ourselves from the abuse of power is insisting that leaders or those who hold power also have character. And it certainly wouldn't be a bad place to start. I think if you insist on that, all of a sudden your Mark Driscolls and your James McDonalds are just out of the picture. Diane Langberg, in her book, Redeeming Power, Understanding Authority and Abuse in the Church, she lays out a very compelling case for redeeming power from abuse, and she's a therapist and authority on trauma and abuse, and she offers, you know, sort of multiple interventions, ways to spot red flags, but the hope for her is that these interventions will circumvent abuse of power. And it makes sense, and Rich Velotta sums up this view well when he says this: the level of power we hold must be commensurate with the level of inner work we have done and are doing. Otherwise, we destroy people and ourselves. And that makes a certain amount of sense to me. The idea is we should never take on more power than our characters can sustain. And so there's multiple people say, okay, the solution here is we need power, we need to exercise it to keep it from abuse, we just need people of integrity and character. And yet, I'm still skeptical. And it was ultimately Diane Langberg who asked the right question in my mind. She asked the question, why is it that even if churches and communities insist on integrity and character formation from the leaders, why is it that so much abuse still happens? And her answer to that is it starts with self-deception. We're too generous in our self-trust. Now, this is coming at an interesting time because Carla, a couple of weeks ago, gave us a sermon on trusting yourself. And I didn't hear it in person, but I listened. I loved that sermon. And Carla and I have had this ongoing conversation from day one. She's like, you need to trust yourself. And I'm like, no, you really can't. Nobody should ever trust themselves. And so we've had a back and forth on this. But I loved her teaching because it actually changed my mind. I realized, listening to her, that I actually do deeply trust my intuition. And so it was a good exercise being able to sit under Carla and hear that and realize, okay, I do. So what is it that I don't trust about myself? Well, I don't know about you, but in my head, there's always a war going on. And I don't know if you remember way back in the day, we did a series, I think we should do it again, on the elephant and the rider and how the mind works like an elephant that does what it's going to do, and the rider is the conscious part of our brain who makes excuses for why the elephant, no, that was intentional. We did that because then it's like, our self-justifying brain can be harmful. And I would say this, even a person of great character can justify harmful actions with enough mental gymnastics. And I want to tell you, it's not just church leaders. We're all capable of doing mental gymnastics. And I want to illustrate the point this morning. Now, don't kill me when I say this, but I'm going to make a statement. Just want you to feel how you react to this, all right? You ready? I believe people who download torrents or share streaming service passwords like Netflix or others, people who share those with people outside of their homes are violating the spirit of the law and thus are people who lack integrity and moral character. Oh, okay. Right there, Carrie, that was perfect. Oh, really? Oh, really? Now, I'm one of those people, so relax, we're all in this together. But the moment somebody says to you, if you're in on something like, hey, I don't want to pay for HBO, I'm going to download Game of Thrones for free, or hey, I don't want to pay for all these streaming services, so I'll share with friends. The moment you get called on that, what happens? Whoa. The rich man, we're just taking from the rich man here. Charges too much for these streaming services. Immediately we go into, but it's justifiable to do that. So sure, maybe it's a little sketchy, but it's justifiable. Immediately our minds so often, as we were talking about last week, go into that defensive posture. And I think the reality is, even the person of great character can justify even harmful actions with enough mental gymnastics. And listen, I don't want to rehash the church's dirty laundry. But if you look at the fallen leaders within the church over the past 5 years, virtually all of those stories seem to involve a leader who was somehow able to justify, in some capacity, harmful behaviors. And I don't think it's any accident that it keeps happening, because we all have that ability in our mind. And those with power are even more susceptible to it. I swear, there's a social media algorithm that listens to my thoughts, because the moment I started working on this power series, boom, an Atlantic article popped up, and its title was, Power Causes Brain Damage. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And so, of course, I read it with great interest. And this is fascinating to me, because two neurologists, David Owen and Jonathan Davidson, they have studied leaders and their brains over the years, and they believe power actually causes a neurological syndrome. They call it hubris syndrome, a disorder of the possession of power, particularly power which has been associated with overwhelming success, held for a period of years and with minimal constraint of the leader. And according to them, this syndrome causes 14 clinical features, including a manifest contempt for other people, loss of contact with reality, restless or reckless action, and displays of incompetence. And their argument is power, particularly when it's coupled with success, actually damages the brain. When I read this, I thought, oh no, do I need to pray, Lord, please make sure I'm a failure in every way so I don't get this brain syndrome here? That's a tough one to get your head around. But it's actually very concerning. And they go in and start talking about different leaders that they've studied over time and how that success leads to just brain blockage. We start to believe your own tales. Even a person of great character can justify harmful actions with enough mental gymnastics, especially if they have both success and power. And when it comes to my anthropology, I tend to have a fairly low one. It brings me back to my original question. How do we prevent abuse of power from happening within the church, within this church, within our lives and relationships? And I don't know. I really don't. And the temptation will always be to look for measures of success in a church. And in that temptation, power performs and delivers. And despite what we might want to say about forming character and integrity, the mind is a tricky thing. And so the best thing I can point to, I think, is a vision of an alternative kind of power that I think we see in Jesus in the Gospels, the power of being among one another. And I think it's unleashed when we submit to one another in trust, love, and mutuality. What does this alternative form of power look like? Well, I think it looks like the cross. You know, it's interesting because the Apostle Paul called the cross a scandal, and I think it's hard for us to grasp this, but to the very first Christians, their hero, their leader, their king being crucified would be the last thing a Jew or a Roman in those days would celebrate or boast about, but the early Christians did. And Paul was like, I know this is foolishness. This is complete foolishness to anyone on the outside, but Paul also said it's the wisdom and power of God. He contends the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. And Paul doesn't mean here, hey, even when God's weak, he's stronger than us, because that's not really scandalous. That's just, okay, a typical boast about conventional power. Rather, Paul is saying God's power is weakness. And if you think about that for a moment, it's an assertion that's still scandalous because I don't know about you, but I find myself still fascinated by conventional power, people who have the power to influence, the power to legislate, the power to purchase, the power to enforce our will, the power to kill. And any form of powerlessness is just, it just puts us off. But it's precisely the powerlessness of God enacted by Jesus on the cross that somehow saves the world. And so the cross gives us a vision of what this alternative form of power looks like. But how does that play out? Well, I want to tell you the story of Jesus and Zacchaeus. And I'm sure many of us know this story, have heard this story. For me, it was that song back in Sunday school. But I want us to look at this story through the lens of power. I want to ask yourself, while we're going through this story, where's the power here? Because something big happens and changes. So where's the power? Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed up into the sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. And since Jesus was coming that way, it's still stuck in my head. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. And all the people saw this and began to mutter, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount. Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." Where's the power there? And you know, the story is short on detail. I would love to have been privy to that dinner table conversation. What did Jesus say? We aren't given the details, but where's the power here? Because something happens. A thief and a cheat completely does a 180. Has his life upended and changed? And you know, it's interesting to me because the Roman system actually had a system for dealing with people like Zacchaeus. The idea was this: if you are caught cheating or taking money from someone, you had to pay it back plus 10%. But Zacchaeus here goes way beyond the system of the day. There's a power at work here. So where is it? Well, I would say this: what we don't see is any kind of power over move. Jesus issues no command and gives no directive. He employs nothing we would normally associate with power over. The only request that Jesus makes of Zacchaeus is to be with him as a guest. Jesus goes, stays with Zacchaeus, eats with him at his table, and becomes Zacchaeus' guest. And these, to me, are the actions of someone who's gone among a people, not over a people. Jesus assumes here no position of privilege. Sitting at a table is an act of fellowship. It's the act of becoming equal among others, giving up any posture of privilege or power, especially as a guest. David Fitch writes this: "What Jesus did was an affront to those people around him, because Jesus did not posture himself over against the hated tax collector. It was out of the space of non-privilege that Zacchaeus was transformed, that he was saved, and indeed his whole house became a manifestation of that salvation. It appears then that Jesus did not use or leverage privilege or ask Zacchaeus to do the same. Jesus offers an alternative beyond leveraging your privilege. It was by pure power of his presence at a table that disruption and subversion happened, and the result was an overthrow of the system as opposed to using it. Jesus enters the world to be among people from which he made space for the power of God to be unleashed wherever he was physically present." Power is unleashed here. It's a different kind of power, a power that comes in weakness, the weakness of just being with and among. And again, I don't know how to get there, but I can vision a little. There's something powerful unleashed when people gather around a table as equals. Pick this up from the Atlantic as well this week. It's fascinating. Consider the family dinner table. Sociologist Cody Delestrati, has been exploring the most recent scientific studies around family dinner tables. And what he has found is remarkable to me. Consider some of his findings. The single most important element in raising kids who are drug-free, healthy, intelligent, kind human beings is frequent family dinners. Regularly sitting down together at a table is also the most important predictor of success for elementary-age children. Primary factor in shaping vocabulary for younger children is frequent family dinners. Key variable associated most with a lower incident of depressive and suicidal thoughts between 11 and 18-year-olds is frequent family dinners. And he concludes, even when you take all the other variables out, the act of sitting around a table has a transformative power. This guy isn't a person of faith, but he uses this language. He calls sitting around a table, sharing a meal with others, a quasi-sacramental experience. And he says the benefits are not just families. It says we foster security and bond with others when we sit shoulder to shoulder and share a meal with any motley crew of individuals. And N.T. Wright picks up on this in his work. He says, when Jesus himself wanted to explain to his disciples what his forthcoming death was all about, he didn't give them atonement theory, he gave them a meal. Jesus' whole life is his example of leading out of a hospitable context, leading from among and with others, not above and over. From his miracle at the wedding at Cana to his frequent attendance
at dinner parties, and I'm so intrigued when you look at Jesus' eating practices. So far as I can tell, Jesus sat at any and every table to which he was invited, regardless of those in attendance. Didn't seem to care who was there, didn't seem to care what the meal was about, didn't care about people's history or positions or beliefs. And as far as we can tell, Jesus never had an agenda at the table. It wasn't like, tonight at dinner with Jesus, we'll be talking about the pros and cons of the Romans delivering universal health care to the empire, yes or no. There's no debate. It's not, hey, tonight Jesus gives us 5 tips for marriage at dinner. No, it's just eat. No agenda. Alice Juliet, in her book Eating Together, says that there's a unique power to being together as equals at a dinner table. She says it reduces people's perceptions of inequality, and people tend to view other people of different races, genders, socioeconomic backgrounds as more equal than they would in other social situations. I don't know exactly how to get there, but in the Gospels I see a vision of a different kind of power. Power around a table where people are truly present. And has me wondering, I have a few wonderings to share with you. I wonder. I was tuning in a couple weeks ago to our members of parliament, and they were discussing things on the floor. Don't even remember what the issue was. And I was dismayed by our political discourse, you could say. It's kind of depressing. Speaker, I'd like to say something. Boo, boo. I'm like, are we in grade 2 here? I was like, ah. And then I wonder what would happen if Pierre Poilievre, Justin Trudeau, Jagmeet Singh, Yves Blanchet, I wonder if they went to lunch together once a week, no mics, no cameras, no agenda. I wonder. I don't know. I wonder what would happen. Once a week, lunch, no agenda, no reporters, no mics, no cameras. I wonder. I was driving by Trinity Bible Church a couple weeks ago, and I wondered. I wondered to myself, what would happen right now if I pulled into this parking lot, walked into the building, and said to Pastor Jacob Riom, let's have a lunch? You might be like, why? What for? No agenda. Let's just go and talk about families, whatever. I wonder what would happen. And no doubt there'd be potential for trouble. Being at a table doesn't mean we're always going to be comfortable or safe. In fact, you look at Jesus's dinners, and a lot of times people got quite uncomfortable. It wasn't always a safe place at Jesus' dinner table. But I don't know. Would it go horribly? Would he call me names and say, you're a heretic? Would I be like, hey, you really should have shut down Ogurga? I don't know. But I can't help but wonder, what would happen? No agenda, just a lunch invitation. I won't know because I'm a coward and didn't do it, but well, there's been so much discussion lately about sexuality, and I can't help, I wonder, what would happen if a transgender person, a non-binary person, and that parent who's concerned about the messaging receiving in school around sexuality, I wonder what would happen if they had lunch. And the point of the lunch wasn't to figure out all these big questions around sexuality. No, just no agenda. I wonder. What would happen? What would happen if that avid hunter in the States, who's a First Amendment enthusiast and he's convinced he's a responsible gun owner, I wonder what would happen if that person went out with the parent who lost a child to a school shooting and there was no agenda. It wasn't about, hey, let's figure out how to do gun reform. It was just lunch. I wonder. I have a big idea that I've never shared with you all. I'm too afraid to try it. But I'm going to give you my vision. You know, we've tried a lot of things here at Nexus, small groups, spiritual direction groups, pub theology, podcast theology, tried a variety of groups here. I've long yearned for a group that looks like this. Here's my vision. We have dinner together. And it could be simple or elegant. It could be pizza. It could be pasta. But there's no agenda. No agenda. A meal with wine in a mixed group, not just friends. It's not a friend group. Fellow pilgrims on the path coming from different areas. And, you know, in my mind, right, because this would be perfect. Sarah told me this morning she doesn't like this idea. But after dinner, you clear the table and you pour some wine, maybe some port, some scotch. In my mind, you have to have smoke at these types of things, so somebody needs to bring a pipe, a cigar. It's just better when there's smoke hanging in the air for these types of things. So that's my dream. Yours might be different. And that's the whole agenda, and we come in with one thought. God is at work in my life, and maybe the people around this table can help me see it. And that's it. It's not, hey, we're going to discuss Trinitarian theology and try to figure that. No, no agenda. Just an understanding that God is at work in my life and maybe the people around this table can help me see it. And maybe it starts with someone just, hey, here's what I've been noticing about life. And then you get the wine going, you get the pipe going, and you just speak into that. That's my dream. I'd love it, but I'm too scared to try on an organizational level, let alone actually invite people over to my house to do something like this. But I can't help but wonder, what would happen if we just committed to being around tables with no agenda, understanding that God's at work in our life, and maybe these people might help me see it. You know, I was interested. Somebody just brought this to my attention a few weeks ago. It's blowing my mind. Do you know what the very first problem is in the Bible? The very first problem addressed in the Bible? Now, if you're like me, standard answer, quick answer is like, yes, it's sin. Genesis 3, sin happens. Breaking of shalom between God, us, the earth, ourselves. But that isn't the case. First problem we see in the Bible, the first problem that plagues the human condition is loneliness. Loneliness. Genesis 2, Adam's lonely. Because nobody truly sees him. Nobody truly knows him. He isn't seen. There's no one to be fully present to him. And of course, he finds it. Then it's lost again in Genesis 3. But the first problem the Bible presents to us is human loneliness. And when I heard that, my mind immediately shot back to that Lent sermon I gave where I read our cards, the pain of this community, and how often that word came up, lonely. From right in our midst, where does it hurt? Loneliness. Loneliness. And so again, I wonder, what would happen if we just sat around tables more often? Without a power dynamic, no agenda, no debate about hot topics, no trying to change someone else's mind, just an intentionality to be present in order to figure out what God is doing among us. I wonder. I'm going to ask the band to come, but I was at a Jesus Collective conference. It's a thingy. And I was there, and we got to talking, and somebody said, hey, Brad, you know, he takes the summers off, his church does. And people were like, what? Oh, my goodness. Every pastor's like, I want to do that. And what I realized is that this is becoming a thing. A whole lot more churches are doing this. But I got defensive because I hate saying we take the summer off. And I know last week I talked about humility. I got to lower my defenses. So I get it. I take vacation in the summer, but the whole summer is not me just sitting around. Anyway, I'm getting defensive again. Never mind. Could we, though, reframe the way we do summer here? We're not taking a break, and we're not pausing church. What we're doing is creating space to be present with and among one another in a way we can't on a typical Sunday morning. I think if we allowed it, the way we do summers is a potential answer to the very first problem the Bible addresses, and that's loneliness. And you see, the goal of our summers is no agenda. You don't have to come and listen to some guy talk. No agenda. It's just space to be present among and with one another. And when we create space for that, I can't help but wonder what might happen. We're going to close with a song that I think a few of us just discovered this week. And I want to say about this song that there are times when I read books and I go, wow, that really helped and nurtured my faith. And then there are moments when a song like this comes along and I go, oh, I believe. There's songs that make you feel like you believe something, that you're in. And this song by Bruce Colburn has a new album out this week, and it just, I think, hit a number of us in the right spot this week. It just restores a certain hope. I hope you enjoy it as we close, and then Carla will come and pray. Dave?